Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster, along with my friend Bob Dio, on the other side of the glass in our space age control room at KVOI. Bob, my engineer producer, who does such a great job for us here on the Buckmaster Show. It is Tuesday. Where did February go? Well, short month, I guess. February 26th, 2019. You're on 10:30. Tucson's voice for trusted local news and talk. We have our worldwide live listening. That means if you've got a computer, you can listen to this program anywhere in the world at buckmastershow.com. That's my website. And of course, 247kvoi.com. All of our programs are available on podcast 24/7. It's on your schedule. Again, at buckmastershow.com. 790-2040 is our live line number if you would like to join in the conversation. And our topic today is a hot one at the state legislature anyway. It's water. Agriculture is by far the biggest user of water in Arizona, using about 74% of Arizona's water supply, according to the Department of Water Resources. Municipalities, in contrast, use about 21%. Just what is the future of agriculture in Arizona as water becomes more and more critical as the state grows? With me to address that question, Dr. Jeff Silvertooth is with us, professor and associate dean at the University of Arizona College of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science. Dr. Silvertooth is the director of the UA Cooperative Extension. Jeff, it's good to see you. Good to renew our friendship. We talked many times during my TV show years over at Channel 6, and now welcome to the radio.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. Appreciate you having me.
So let's begin with this question. Big picture, overview, does agriculture have a future in this state?
Well, of course, I have a bias.
You're going to say yes, indeed.
Coming here as an agronomist.
There you go.
I'm open-minded about it as well, but I would say absolutely it does. But the complexion of Arizona agriculture is certainly going to change in the next several decades.
How is it going to change, Dr. Silvertooth?
Well, there's a couple things that are going to drive it, one of which, as you mentioned earlier, is the water. Water issues, water availability, water supply.
Right.
This is increasingly an urban state, and we have right now, 7.2 million people in the state, with about, plus or minus, 5 million in the Phoenix area.
Sure.
And about another million right around here in Tucson.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest sprinkled out around the state. And as we look at this, the complexion of our demographics in the state are shifting. And so the demands in the of water, the demands for food, and the demands from the public with regard to what they want and what they want to see. So we're already seeing changes in the face of agriculture, but it's a matter for us all the time to be folks in agriculture, to be flexible, have some dexterity.
It is hard for, I think, folks to follow the complexities, Jeff, of what's been coming out of the legislature concerning the CAP and the water compacts. Can you kind of give us bottom line how it affects the farming industry in this state?
I'll try to do that.
Try,
because
if
it
you
is,
can.
It
I
is
know it's
complicated.
Very complex, and we're short on time, as
it
usual.
It is complex, but let's do the elevator type approach.
Please.
So, see, the CAP is a Central Arizona project.
Right.
And the Central Arizona project brings Colorado River water out of the Colorado River near the Bill Williams River confluence and takes it into Central Arizona. Lifts it about 2,700 feet. The end of the line for the CAP is right out here by Tucson, Arizona. Right now, you look at the CAP, it provides water and supports about 80% of the population in the state. And that's huge. And it also represents the biggest portion of surface water that's used in Arizona. The main stem of the Colorado River provides 40% of the water for the overall state.
Mm-hmm.
The other 40% is coming from groundwater, and the rest, 20%, is coming from other sources, like the Salt River Project, or the Gila River.
Right.
But so the CAP is huge for this state in terms of our water supplies today. It was finished about 1989.
Mm-hmm.
I think, matter of fact, 50 years ago on September 30th, Lyndon Johnson signed the bill.
Yeah, it's 50th anniversary of
the CAP.
Yeah.
It was built subsequent to that after it was finished about 1989, 1990. But it today supplies supplies water to about 80% of the population and about almost 40% of the total water in the state. So it's big in that way.
Is agriculture getting what you think they are they happy with their allotment?
What they're happy with their allotment, with what's coming off the CAP as it stands in the structure of the law today. Mm-hmm. The problem we're facing now, which it really adds to the complexity, is that we've been experiencing a drought for about 17 years, as you know, out here in the desert southwest, and the reservoir levels in Lake Mead are going down. And as they've proceeded to go down, anybody that's been up there, driven across the bridge, you look down, you see that bathtub ring, and it's pronounced.
Yeah.
And it's dropping fast. Well, the projections are that it might hit a critical point, and that's at 1,075 feet on the dam level above sea level at a projected point from the Bureau of Reclamation by January 1. Projections are right now, Bill, unless we get a miraculous snowpack for about 3 years in the basin, the watershed, we'll probably hit 1075 in 2020, maybe 2021. So all this business going on in the legislature, all this all this ruckus that we see going on is all centered around how to develop a drought contingency plan, because when that 1075 mark is hit, Arizona is going to lose a lot of water fast, because Arizona accepted to get the canal built, the CAP. We accepted low priority water on the Colorado River for the CAP.
To get that water for the state.
And in 2004 agreement, the rural areas of Arizona on the CAP accepted the lowest priority water to be able to make a deal at the time. They didn't anticipate this happening. It's like a lot of us that buy insurance or do a lot of stuff, build houses on the coast. We don't anticipate these things happening, but now it's coming to bear. So we have a crisis looming on the horizon.
I want to talk with you briefly. I've got about 4 minutes, Professor Silvertooth. What about cotton? It's very water intensive. People say maybe cotton farmers. First of all, how much cotton farming is still being done in the state?
Well, we have a little under 200,000 acres of cotton production in Arizona today. And you put that in contrast, when I first came here to Arizona 33 seasons ago, 32 years ago, We had 500,000 acres of cotton in the state.
So we're about half then.
Less than half.
Okay.
And so it's been condensed into various pockets of the state, similar distributions we had before. Still an important crop, but a much more of a minor crop today than it was 30 years ago.
What about the water issue with cotton?
Right.
Could the cotton farmers go to something else?
Well, they're gonna have to do one of two things.
Okay.
When you get a reduction, you and I are farming, we get a reduction of water. We either have to grow less acreage, reduce our acreage, or keep the same acreage, change crops, or change sequencing of crops. That might mean you go to more winter-type crops. The problem is, Bill, we can grow about anything you can think of out here in Arizona with some season in the low desert. Like right now, the Winter Vegetable Production Center of the United States is in Yuma.
Right.
And it'll just move around, but we can do that here. The problem that we have is that finding a crop that you can grow in a season niche and it still has a good market for the farmer. You still have to make a living. It's still, capitalistic enterprise.
I'm going to have to bring you back for a full half hour because there's so many areas. Like I just thought of the situation with Yuma. Have they been devastated, the lettuce farmers over there, with that whole E. coli scare?
Oh my gosh, that's another story.
Yeah, it is. We could spend a half hour on that, I'm sure.
That's been huge.
Yeah,
it is. It's still huge.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a classic example right there of what we expect as Americans, and we get it, and that's a high quality, safe, clean product that comes out of these fields, and it's relatively cheap for us in America today.
Are they recovering?
They're recovering, but boy, I tell you, they're making a lot of effort. They make huge efforts to they already were making huge efforts to protect the crop from contamination.
But the publicity alone is just a killer.
Well,
it's got to be a killer.
You think about it, somebody eats one salad, it's contaminated, and it wrecks the whole industry.
Oh, yeah. 10:30, The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll keep it here for another minute or so, a minute and a half, with Professor Silvertooth, who is the director of the UA Cooperative Extension. That's another half hour we could spend time. Land grant university or in this state or in this country, 50 of them, they all have a cooperative extension.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's a good story right there for us.
So there's a lot. We're going to bring you back for sure. But we've heard a lot about hemp production. And there is some talk that, it's 30% less water intensive than cotton. Do we really know that, since most of the hemp production has been up in the rainy areas of the Northwest?
Well, I tell you, here's a shocking truth. is we don't know that. We haven't actually had a chance to measure that out here. And I have another shocking thing to tell you, Bill, is that myth's been pushed around as if it's fact now. And those of us at the university, several of my colleagues, we look at each other all the time thinking, we don't know that. And we hope it's less water. But when we get the crop out here to be able to test in the field, that's when we're going to find out. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be what does a good thing about it is we always need more, say, opportunities on our palate. It's kind of like a menu.
Sure.
To crops that we can grow. And I think
we'll see how
have
it
a
does.
Place.
We'll exactly. see how it does. It's a summer crop.
Right.
Mainly use will be fiber. Whether medicinal will eventually get part of the portfolio.
Right.
Yeah, it's still to come.
Right. And that's a good example. You mentioned cooperative extension. That's what we do. We go out and they test materials, products like this, develop protocols, work with the industries, and then we actually bring science to bear on practical problems, and this is a good example of a practical problem in the state.
All right.
We respond to that.
We may add Dr. Silvertooth to the Buckmaster Show contributor list under the category of agriculture.
I'd be glad to do that.
There is a lot to talk about. It was great to see you again and renewing our friendship and acquaintance, and we will have you back on the show.
I appreciate the chance to be here, Bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. This portion of our program, Jeff, is presented by my favorite bakery in town. Do you like bakery goods?
Absolutely.
Oh, there you go. Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's located at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. I announced yesterday some very exciting news. Mona's will soon be serving by mid-March. They're putting in a facility for doing a full hot breakfast.
Cool.
At Mona's. Right now, of course, they're ready for your lunch. The bread that you will be served on your sandwich came out of the oven just a couple of hours ago. They do such a great job. So breakfast will be coming online. You can find out more about Mona's by going to monasdanishbakery.com. You can also go to my website, buckmastershow.com. There's a link to all of our great partners, about 20 different partners who help support this program. Also a list of our great contributors. There's 24 folks from various fields. And I guess what? I'll make an announcement right here on the air. If you're willing to accept Professor Silvertooth, you are now going to be the Buckmaster Show Agriculture Contributor.
My pleasure to do so, Bill. Thank you.
There you got it.
That's contract.
The acceptance right there. All right. We'll take our break. Be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
Did you know that you can check out complete digital editions of popular magazines with your Pima County Public Library card? From Arizona Highways to Yoga Journal and everything in between, the library is your source for entertainment. Visit library.pima.gov and browse the e-library to start checking out your favorite magazines today. That's library.pima.gov.
For the first time ever, explore the Biosphere 2 Ocean and Beach and see up close how we're using the world's largest indoor living ocean for research on the future of coral reefs and rising ocean temperatures. During this privately guided tour, you'll learn why our world's oceans are so important, why they're being impacted, and how the Biosphere 2 Research Center is addressing the global challenges of food, water, energy, and health. The University of Arizona Biosphere 2 tours daily, biosphere2.org. The Regional Transportation Authority has a 35-member Citizens Advisory Committee working to identify transportation priorities for the region and will be seeking public input on those priorities before too long. These priorities will help guide development of an RTA continuation plan. The current RTA plan and half-cent excise tax will continue through June 2026. To learn more, please visit rtamobility.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I'm passionate about travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. And when I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport. With 9 airlines flying nonstop to 22 destinations and easy one-stop connections, I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient with competitive airfares, and there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local independent nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com.
Shelley Fishman, CFP, is a financial planner and investment advisor professional. The opinions voiced on this program segment are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing.
And what say we consult right now is Shelley Fishman, certified financial planner who is on The Buckmaster Show, 1030 The Voice Live Line, trusted local news and talk. Shelley is on the live line because he's at an advisor luncheon. Shelley, how you doing today?
Okay, actually, I'll be at the luncheon in about 2 left turns.
Okay. Well, while you're on your way to the luncheon, so we don't know what the investment advisor firm, or do we know what they're saying?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because what's become clear over the past couple of weeks as the 2018 GDP numbers are beginning to firm up, those are coming in at about 3%. And that, of course, is far less than what was forecasted by the administration. And it looks like 2019 is going to come in somewhere between 2 and 3%, but certainly less than the 4 or 5% that was optimistically forecasted, again, by the administration. So what's happened is that all of the major investment firms are trying to figure out how to explain that to clients, number one, how to recommend investment strategies to clients in the face of what is probably a 70 or 80% consensus that 2020 or maybe early 2021 is going to see a negative growth or a recession. So that pretzel bending is going on in some very weird ways. We're being told by people who used to be deficit hawks and very conservative budget people that we don't have to worry about deficits anymore. They're kind of not a problem between now and 10 or 15 years from now. That there's no headwinds to the economy that appear to be so grossly dangerous that an investor should really worry about them, and that it's all right to continue to invest in equities and be optimistic about the economy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I'm now hearing from people who 2 years ago were predicting gloom and doom because of the slow pace of the economic recovery. So I find that kind of alarming, Bill, and I thought we should talk about it a little bit today.
Well, people are worried about a recession being on the horizon and what they should do, what your how should your portfolio reflect the possible well, there'll be a recession sometime, so putting possible recession may be possible in the immediate near future.
Yeah, so what you will hear from your advisors the day after the recession is made evident in the markets, that is, there's a large decline, is stay the course. And you'll hear that as kind of a recorded announcement, and it's the right recorded announcement. Because once the market has dropped 1,000 points in a day or 1,500 points in 2 days, whatever the number is at these inflated numbers as they are today, it's too late. Then you have to ride it out, and so stay the course is probably decent advice. However, between now and then, it's a pretty good idea to take a serious look at your investments in your portfolio and see how you can protect yourself against downside risk while at the same time not taking yourself completely out of investing altogether.
Shelley Fishman is with us on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Shelley is our certified financial planner, and it is our Tuesday Money Maker Report. So what are some of the strategies that you are recommending, Shelley?
Well, and I'll confess, Bill, that we started talking about this a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to lighten up. So if you're 30 or 35 years old, do nothing. Stay aggressive. You ride through it. You're going to be fine. If you're in your 50s or early 60s or into retirement, then what you really have to think about doing is making your portfolio more conservative and more dividend and interest rich in the short term, so that when the recession hits, you will have some income coming into that portfolio. And at the same time, it will be less volatile on the downside, because those kinds of instruments, owning bonds or high dividend stock portfolios or the funds that hold those things, tend to be less volatile than more aggressive stocks. So that's one thing to do. The other thing to do is to take some amount of money out of the portfolio that's invested and hold it in cash or cash equivalents for a while, something that's very liquid that you can get to. And then when you're convinced that the downside has reached the bottom, and I'm not suggesting market timing, but you know, when things start to go south really bad, you know it. And then on that weakness, it's a good time to begin to get in back into the market, maybe with dollar cost averaging or something, in a way that will keep you invested and enable you to buy the investments in the proper allocation for your risk tolerance and age that would get you back in, get your allocation back where it should be, but buy those instruments at a discount.
Well, if the government begins to move in the direction of higher spending, Shelley Fishman, and higher taxes, what does history tell us about growth in both the economy and equity markets? And we've got only about 2 minutes for a
pretty complicated question.
But
yeah, this is the counterintuitive stuff. What we find is that government spending, if that government spending is direct, let's say in infrastructure, that kind of thing is stimulative. So that's good for the economy. It might be bad for deficits, but it's good for the economy. If that goes along with tax hikes, especially tax hikes that are intended to correct income disparity, what we've seen historically is that as taxes go up, GDP growth goes up. Now, that's counterintuitive, but there's a lot of research to show that. There are some people, Paul Ryan, for instance, who think that there's no connection between the two. But if you take a look since the end of World War II, every time we've had an increase in the top end of taxes and in the upper middle end of taxes, GDP growth has actually increased. So the counterintuitive answer to your question is it's probably a good thing as long as we don't overdo it by spending way more than our tax revenue brings in. Today, taxes, if government spending is at around 20% of GDP, we're taxing and getting revenues at a rate of around 17 or 18% of GDP. There's a 3% gap. If we go up 2% in government spending, then we've got to find that money from the tax base somehow.
All right, Shelley, we're going to wrap it up. But right now, we've had a pretty good run into the first couple of months, haven't we, of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. Things are high. This is not a bad time to begin to think about the strategies we discussed earlier.
Thank you very much, Shelley. Have a good meeting, a luncheon meeting today. Shelley Fishman on the Buckmaster Show. Thanks, Shell.
The opinions voiced in this program segment are for general information only and are not necessarily those of Securities America or this station. Shelley Fishman, CFP, is a financial planner and investment advisor in private practice here in Tucson. Securities offered through Securities America, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through PFG Advisors. Securities America and PFG Advisors are separate entities.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
Did you know that you can check out complete digital editions of popular magazines with your Pima County Public Library card? From Arizona Highways to Yoga Journal and everything in between, the library is your source for entertainment. Visit library.pima.gov and browse the e-library to start checking out your favorite magazines today. That's library.pima.gov.
For the first time ever, explore the Biosphere 2 ocean and beach and see up close how we're using the world's largest indoor living ocean for research on the future of coral reefs and rising ocean temperatures. During this privately guided tour, you'll learn why our world's oceans are so important, why they're being impacted, and how the Biosphere 2 Research Center is addressing the global challenges of food, water, energy, and health. The University of Arizona Biosphere 2, tours daily, biosphere2.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Hi, it's Suzanne Miller from your Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona, here to remind you to start with trust and look for the BBB accredited seal when searching for a product or service. Did you know you can request a quote directly from any of our accredited businesses? With over 3,000 accredited businesses in Southern Arizona, you will find a business you can trust. Whether you need a product or service from one company or an entire industry, go to tucson.bbb.org and start your search today.
Southern Arizona is home to one of the world's most trusted sources of information on medicines. The Credible Meds website is visited each day by over 2,000 people from more than 60 countries. You too can learn how to personalize your medications and take control of your health care. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and join Bill Buckmaster each month as he and Dr. Ray Woosley, founder of Credible Meds, give you practical tips on how to get the most from your medications.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Buckmaster on a Tuesday on 10:30, the voice trusted local news and talk. We're with you live Monday through Friday right here on 10:30, the voice. Support for Buckmaster comes from one of our great sponsors, Green Things, 3384 East River Road. They're over by the Rito River. What a beautiful location, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. It's a 13-acre site, and now the big news over at Green Things, which has been around since 1970, they also have Zocalo, a great collection of Talavera pottery, antiques, fine art, handmade furniture, lighting, home accessories, and gifts. So you can get all of your amazing plants, trees, annuals, and more at Green Things, and then all that great accessories and some of the beautiful handmade furniture from Mexico and Peru at Zocalo. Zocalo for years used to be over by Country Club and Broadway. They're now part of the Green Things family. The website, greenthingsaz.com. Scientists are retracing the theory of the moon's craters to explain why the Earth lacks them. In other words, why is Earth so smooth while the moon is so heavily cratered, recording thousands of impacts since it formed some 4.5 billion years ago? The authors of a paper published recently in the journal Science found just 190 confirmed impact craters on Earth. Now, that's far less than would be expected if the impact rate then were the same as it is now. Joining me in studio to hopefully make some sense of this is Dr. William Hartman, a senior scientist and co-founder of the Tucson-based Planetary Science Institute, which has been a successful nonprofit here in town for over 40 years. Dr. Hartman is the recipient of the first Carl Sagan Medal given by the American Astronomical Society for popular presentation of scholarly research. Dr. Hartman has had an amazing career, and if I were really to do it credit, I'd probably need about a whole day just to talk about his resume that includes, along with the Planetary Science Institute co-founder Don Davis, the development their theory in the 1970s of the giant impact hypothesis for the formation of the moon. Now, their theory shows our moon was formed from debris from a giant impact that resulted when a large asteroid crashed into Earth. Bill Hartman he's a true Renaissance man. He's critically acclaimed painter, terrific artist, historian, novelist. His previous books include A Traveler's Guide to Mars. When did that come out, Bill? How many years ago?
Oh, that was 2003, I guess.
Wow, I think that one may be needing an update because maybe we're getting closer to needing a guidebook to Mars. Other books, Desert Heart, it's a classic. Your novel titled Cities of Gold and your most recent book, Searching for Golden Empires, Epic Cultural Collisions in 16th Century America. That's published by the University of Arizona Press. Bill, always a pleasure to see you.
Great to be on your show, Bill.
You know, speaking of the 16th century America and the collisions and cultures, I was just reflecting the other day about your book. For 400 years, people have been coming back and forth. And, of course, there was no international boundary hundreds of years ago. Well, maybe there was, but let's say many hundreds of years ago, and people have been crossing this, coming and going in this region forever, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. I talked about that in the Searching for Golden Empires book, that when Spaniards explorers came up through Sonora, they talked to people who routinely, native people, who routinely went up to what we would call Zuni, New Mexico, which was the seven cities of Cibola, and they would go up and work and come back. And as I said in the book, it's strange to me, and seems to me we need to reflect on it, that under the framework we've built, under the system that we operate on, the people trying to do that would be arrested for a crime, but everybody was happy with it back 500 years ago. So it's a strange thing. We have some Oatom friends that come to some joint meetings, and they have a wonderful comment on that. They have a good sense of humor. And the idea was that, you remember, Southern Arizona was the Gadsden Purchase, and so the new border was created at that time. And, of course, that border goes between families and relatives of the Oatom who did live on both sides.
Right.
So the Oatom friends will say, people say the border, see, people say we crossed the border, but we say the border crossed us.
It's true. It is. And, they don't call it the borderlands for nothing. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason there. Okay, let's get back to my opening statement about, why is the Earth so smooth? Some of your thoughts about that, what I was in my introduction.
Yeah, the solar system is full of smaller bodies, asteroids and comets. Many of the asteroids are concentrated in a belt between Mars and Jupiter, but they get knocked out of the belt occasionally by gravitational effects. So there's always a flux of these objects hitting both the Earth and the Moon. And the Moon has very little geological activity other than those impacts. So you get a recording of most of the impacts on the Moon. They can be destroyed by later impacts. But on the Earth, we have so much active geology. We've got the rain eroding things. We've got mountain building. We've got
the glaciers.
We've got the continental drift, where whole continental masses will crash into each other and one will slide under the other. So the oldest surfaces on the Earth are really have all disappeared. The Atlantic Ocean is only something like 100 million years old.
Wow.
And that's just a few percent of geologic time.
Well, let me ask you something. So if we had not had, if we don't have this kind of activity on Earth, would the Earth look like the Moon?
Yeah, that's right. And it would just look entirely like the Moon. And the early Earth was so different because we didn't even have much oxygen in the atmosphere at the beginning. So if you had aliens landing on the Earth 4 billion years ago, it would have been quite a different planet at that time than what we know.
Well, going back to your 1970s theory hypothesis, has it been proven that you and Don Davis were right, showing that our Moon was formed by the debris from a giant impact that resulted when a large asteroid crashed into Earth?
Yeah, that's certainly still the going premise. And
out of how many premises are floating around?
Well, it's I was at
and
a
is
large.
Is yours near the is with a bullet number one?
Yeah. I was at a large conference in England about 3 or 4 years ago. And it was on that very subject with the question you just asked. Mm-hmm. And is it still kind of the leading idea? And there were lots of questions going on, particularly at that time. But I remember, you know, some of the conference organizers, their phrase was, well, it's the only game in town. It's mm-hmm. the best game in town. It's mm-hmm. all we've got. Mm-hmm. Basically, this idea that there was a large impact. And
how large, by the way?
It's thought that the thing that hit the Earth in order to do this, to do the job, get and blow yeah. some stuff off into orbit that could make the Moon, would have been about the size of Mars.
Wow.
And at that time, at the very beginning of the solar system, 4.5 billion years ago, as you said, mm-hmm. There were a lot of big objects moving around, and they were accumulating, they were aggregating together. The smaller asteroids would hit each other and basically form a new object that was a larger object. And so things were growing, and there were fairly large objects roaming around in the solar system that eventually crashed into other planets.
Why is there just the Moon? Why isn't there other large objects or smaller objects than the Moon that might still be out there?
It seems that there are different classes of moons in the solar system. But Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, there's only the one satellite system mm-hmm. with a big satellite, and that's the Earth. Mm-hmm. But you get out to Jupiter and Saturn, they were so big that they were almost like miniature solar systems, and they formed a family of moon. Mm-hmm. Each one, mm-hmm. Jupiter and Saturn have a whole family of moons. Mm-hmm. Jupiter has 4 big moons and then a whole, you know, dozens of much smaller ones.
Let me ask you, if your theory is right up there at the top, what would be the closest argument against it, Bill Hartman?
There was a really interesting set of arguments that touched off the conference that I just mentioned from a few years ago. And it's kind of a funny story. When Don and I first published this, it was just about at that time that they realized that the rocks in the Earth and the Moon are almost exactly the same in terms of isotope chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you have, like, oxygen has two different forms, two different isotopes, and there's a certain ratio of those. Well, the Earth rocks and the Moon rocks have practically the same ratios. Pretty much everything else in the solar system has different ratios. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when that was discovered, Don and I were puffing out our chests and saying, hey, you know, this fits the theory beautifully,
sure,
because the Moon and the Earth are made out of the same material.
Right.
Well, somehow that got turned around just the opposite. About 10 years ago, the idea was that if there was an impactor, it could very well have come from some other part of the solar system, and then it would have had different isotopes, and the stuff blown off the Earth, which was mostly was material from the Earth and material from the impactor, that would all go into the Moon, and the Moon would have a slightly different isotope ratio, and that wasn't really being seen. And so the evidence that we thought was on our side at the beginning, suddenly people were holding meetings about using that evidence against the theory. Mm-hmm. And what I think is coming out of that, people are working on different models of how the solar system itself evolved, which is helping solve it. But the point that I make is we know there is one class of meteorites still in the solar system, fall out of the sky, hit the ground on Earth. And those, that particular class has exactly the same isotopes as the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So there is there were bodies in the solar system that had the right isotope mix.
When we continue with Dr. William Hartman, we'll talk a little bit about moon rocks and some research and science that he is doing in that area. We're speaking with Dr. William Hartman, Bill Hartman, the recipient of the first Carl Sagan Medal, which was given by the American Astronomical Society. And he is also one of the co-founders of the Tucson-based Planetary Science Institute. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back on the Buckmaster Show.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year transportation plan is funded through June 2026 by a special taxing district, which is a state-established political subdivision within Pima County. The RTA plan and half-cent excise tax were voter-approved in May 2006, and the tax is collected within the district. More about RTA Citizens Advisory Committee's efforts to develop an RTA continuation plan at rtamobility.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com. As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
This is Moa Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing.
And this is Bill Buckmaster. For several decades now, Moe has been my go-to expert for all my framing needs and bathroom mirrors. I trust Moe for service, professionalism, and top-of-the-line quality.
Thanks, Bill. Give us a call at 795-8226 and stop by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing on the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge, right next to Copenhagen, and on the web at moesgallery.com.
Hey, it's Matt Russell from the Buckmaster Show.
And this is Ryan Hansen from Bon Voyage Travel.
I am so pumped to be partnering with Bon Voyage on my next culinary and cocktail cruise.
This is definitely a cruise for foodies as you experience the Mediterranean on celebrity cruises.
And the private excursions that your team has arranged for us? I mean, come on, an ouzo distillery tour in Greece? A food and wine day on Malta?
We'll handle everything, so all you and your guests need to do is eat, drink, and be happy.
Go to bvtravel.com/Matt Russell to learn more.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. This portion presented by Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Just a 3-hour drive from Tucson, a beautiful area of the southwestern United States and the southwestern part of New Mexico. I strongly suggest a road trip over there. I send so many of our listeners to that part of the world, and so many Tucson natives actually have said, I'd never been over there. I liked it very much. A lot of history in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, and the starting place should be southwestnewmexico.org for the complete listing of places to stay and many things to do. Dr. William Hartman, Bill Hartman, is with us, recipient of the first Carl Sagan Medal given by the American Astronomical Society. He's one of the co-founders of the now 40-plus-year-old nonprofit that does so well here in town, Planetary Science Institute. We have Dr. Mark Sykes, the CEO, regularly here on the Buckmaster Show. You know, Dr. Hartman has done so much. I call him a Renaissance man. We've been talking about his hypothesis about the way the moon was formed. We're talking about that in the first segment. And, you know, I was mentioning Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico, Bill Hartman. Well, you've spent some time over there tracing kind of, for one of your books, about Coronado's visit into this part of the world.
Yeah, they were coming up to investigate the rumors of rich cities north of Mexico. Mm-hmm. After the conquest of the Aztecs. And so they came up through Sonora and through the southeast corner of Arizona and went on into New Mexico and spent a winter area around Albuquerque and requisitioned some pueblos, so there was some nasty business there. But, you know, they had some side expeditions that went west from Albuquerque back into Arizona, discovered the Grand Canyon. They had... most people don't know they had a seaward part of the whole expedition with some ships that came up the Gulf and then up the Colorado River and were trying to get to where the land expedition was. They never were able to get together.
I had not heard that. I did not know there was a sea component to the Coronado mission.
Yeah, that's interesting.
How long did the Coronado mission last?
About 2 years. Uh-huh. The first... reconnoitering was by this interesting priest, Marcos de Niza, who reported the seven cities. But the Spanish, I think there was some wonderful kind of mental gymnastics going on because they, back in Mexico City, what they visualized, I mean, Marcos comes back and he correctly describes multi-story buildings and ladders and stone construction. So
that
they were picturing
in Zuni,
yeah,
presumably,
those seven Zuni villages.
They're still there.
Yeah, and now it's basically one village,
one
but there's
village.
Some ruins
right,
scattered around.
Right.
And they thought they were visualizing big European castles, and so they come up with basically like an army armed with crossbows and.
Yeah.
And of course, then they didn't discover any gold. So Marcos goes down as a con man, and I think Marcos actually was reporting things correctly, but in history books he goes down as a fraud. And then in 1540, the next year, he helped lead the expedition back, which I think you wouldn't have done if you were a fraud, because
no.
He would have got caught out.
Yeah.
And they then explored all the way to Kansas in 1542 and finally turned around and went home. And the whole thing was considered a colossal failure.
So our area really has a 500-year European history.
Oh, yeah. And what's interesting about that is it's really the first eyewitness accounts of native life here. I always say that was the last day of prehistory.
Right.
When they started writing something down of what they saw.
Dr. Hartman has that novel, Cities of Gold, and of course, Searching for Golden Empires, Epic Cultural Collisions in 16th Century America. That book still available from the University of Arizona Press. There's always so much to talk with Dr. Hartman about. We haven't even gotten in. And I do want to get, I will talk about the moon rocks, but I want to mention also, he's such an acclaimed painter for folks that have been over on the Big Island of Hawaii at the Volcanoes National Park. There is a gallery. I think they've reopened it now that things have settled down a little bit. Dr. Hartman's work is shown over at the park at the Volcano Center.
It's just a neat place. I like that gallery. I had met them years ago when I was doing astronomy on the Big Island, because we did some of the early work on Mauna Kea Observatory. Mm-hmm. So I got to know the Volcano Art Center gallery people, and I try to keep some new paintings there.
You need to write an autobiography.
Find a publisher.
I think UA Press, folks, are you listening? No, I think it needs to be done. Now, getting back to the first segment of our discussion with you, we're talking about moon rocks, and you've been looking into when the Apollo astronauts came back with rock samples, scientists expected the rocks dating back, 4.5 billion years ago.
Right.
What have you been working on in this regard?
Well, what happened was you're right, that was the expectation, and the idea was, well, nothing much happens on the moon, so it's going to have all these rocks lying around from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't really find much older than 3.9 billion years ago. So 4.5 mm-hmm. is when it started, but the rocks only seem to go back to 3.9.
Why?
So the original theory was that there was some huge cataclysmic cratering at 3.9, mm-hmm. bombardment by asteroids. And so the features that we see on the moon would have all formed about that time. And I like to joke about starting back in those days in the 1970s when that was first developed, that idea. I've been writing about one paper every 10 years on why this isn't correct, and nobody pays any attention.
Uh-huh.
And there's been a lot of discussion about it, and
I think the catastrophe. What you've been writing about, as you say, every 10 years, it looks like that so-called catastrophe never happened.
Yes, that's this big spike in impacts that everybody has kind of believed in apparently didn't happen, and it may be that there was a lot more cratering before that, which simply destroyed the older results. And so the magic thing about 3.9 is that's when rocks began to survive from the early days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the growing modern idea. And, you know, it's uncomfortable for scientists to change a big paradigm like that, a big major idea. But, you know, I always say, on the other hand, it's an example of how science is self-correcting. And, you know, you can't keep wrong ideas going for very long before somebody starts discovering some things show that the wrong idea is actually wrong.
I only have about 40 seconds. You have a book that a science fiction novel set in 2084, and I think you're hoping that will be published soon.
Yeah, we've got it being looked at in New York.
Bottom line with the book? Talks about mining asteroids,
mining
right?
Asteroids, and there's a really neat idea about putting some material between the Earth and the Sun that could solve the whole global warming problem that's been kicked around, and so I play with that idea in the novel.
Didn't you do a science fiction book?
I did.
I recall
a first novel, which was called Mars Underground.
And Mars Underground.
The working title for the new one is Galileo Underground.
Wow. You can probably find all of Dr. Hartman's books on Amazon under William Hartman.
And U of A Press will have a booth at the Festival of Books, and so my Coronado book will be there, for instance.
Very good. Bill Hartman, always a pleasure. Thank you very much, sir.
Great to be here.
All right. William Hartman, what a true Renaissance man. Always a pleasure spending time with him. That's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show on this Tuesday, as we thank Bob Dio. Bob, great job as usual. Thanks to Dr. Hartman. I'm Bill Buckmaster. Coming up next, Steve Rivera, with his sports show, very popular two-hour sports show here on 1030 The Voice. The show is called Eye on the Ball. Steve's always got a lot to talk about. Have a great afternoon.